Hi, everyone. I'm Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor of Lab Medicine Magazine. And for today's podcast, I have with me Dr. Frank Wyons, who's a retired professor of pathology from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. And I also have Dr. Borgi. He was Chief HIPAA Privacy Officer and Vice Chair, Human Subjects Committee at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Today, Dr. Borgi and Dr. Wyons are going to talk with us a little bit about privacy and email and sending protected health information electronically.
Thank you, Kelly. First, I want to thank Dr. Borgi for joining me in this podcast, because Dr. Borgi is an expert on this topic, both in principle and in practice. She and I have also co-authored a companion article on this important topic as well. And thanks also to Kelly and ASCP for giving us the opportunity to talk about a topic that is certainly in the news of recent, albeit not related to email transmission of protected health information, but certainly related to the topic of emails sent by Americans. Specifically, during this podcast, we will discuss five myths regarding email transmission of protected health information, which we will refer to by its common abbreviation, PHI. And Dr. Borgi will discuss the reality with regard to these myths based on both my experience and the more extensive and direct experience of Dr. Borgi on both the topic and the important acts, laws, and rules that provide the legal basis for understanding the rationale, mandates, and penalties associated with violation of these acts, laws, and rules. Of course, the preeminent law and rules associated with email transmission of PHI are HIPAA, known as the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and the Privacy and Security rules. Unfortunately, we will not have time to review this act and the rules in detail. However, our companion publication to this podcast provides that information and excellent links to more detailed information on these important rules and the HIPAA Act. Before we get started, I would like to set the stage on this topic by sharing some current statistics with regard to email in general, and specifically by healthcare providers and other covered entities, to illustrate the overwhelming increase, both now and projected into the future, in the use of electronic modes of communication. And these statistics are rather interesting. Of note, by the end of 2012, total worldwide email traffic was estimated to be over 144 billion, billion with a B, emails per day. And by 2016, that number is expected to increase even further, to over 192 billion emails per day. In addition, it's estimated that U.S. workers spend an average of 4 hours per workday using email, and 39% of email users regularly send, receive, or check emails outside of working hours. And for those of us that feel tethered to our email accounts, we know how true that statistic is. 15% of Americans describe themselves as addicted to email. And lastly, in a market research study conducted by Manhattan Research in 2012, it was estimated that about 80% of U.S. physicians own smartphones, and there is a strong interest in iPads and other emerging technologies, and that by 2012, there will be very few professional activities that healthcare professionals won't be doing on their handhelds. So certainly electronic modes of communication of information, including PHI, are here to stay and will only increase further during our lifetimes. So maintaining the privacy of this information is a major challenge, both now and into the near future, and myths abound with regard to how best to meet this challenge, including the five myths that we will discuss in an attempt to debunk these myths by providing the reality based on a reasonable interpretation of HIPAA and the privacy and security rules. So we're going to start out with presenting the five myths, and Dr. Borgi will respond to each one of them. So Dr. Borgi, with regard to myth number one, there are no restrictions on the content and amount of PHI that can be sent by email. What is the reality?
Well, you know, that's a very commonly held misconception about what HIPAA speaks to in terms of what you can send by email. And I think it's really important to remember that the regulations don't specify that level of detail in terms of what a covered entity or a clinician can or cannot send by email. Rather, what the regulations do are to create a framework for determining what is allowable on a case-by-case basis by the individual who wants to send the information. And I think this question really gets at one key component of HIPAA, which is the concept known as minimum necessary. Minimum necessary is a standard which is found in the privacy rule, and it refers to only using that PHI which is needed for a given purpose. So minimum necessary doesn't in and of itself describe what is the minimum amount of PHI necessary for a given use or disclosure. Rather, HIPAA requires that a covered entity or a clinician to set policies and procedures to support this minimum necessary requirement that's in the regulation. The one area that HIPAA does specify regards uses and disclosure of PHI for treatment purposes where there is no minimum necessary principle that needs to be adhered to, because obviously when you're treating a patient, you need all the information to be available to make any treatment kind of decisions. And this is where I think the confusion arises, that people know that they're sending information by email for treatment purposes, so they presume there's no restriction. So we need to then come to a second key concept in HIPAA, which is that covered entities, or in lay terms, that's, you know, individuals or organizations that are subject to HIPAA, they must take reasonable and appropriate steps to ensure that the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of PHI is protected. So in the case of email, there's a number of risks associated with transmitting PHI by email. And because of these risks, it's recommended that even in a treatment context, the amount of PHI should be limited to the minimum necessary for a given purpose. I think it's also worth noting that HIPAA isn't the only regulation that is applicable here. State and other federal laws may impact what's appropriate to send by email. Many states regulate the confidentiality of sensitive information, such as HIV status and mental health information. Substance abuse treatment information is regulated federally, and Social Security numbers have a number of requirements that vary by state in terms of what you need to do to protect that information. So anyone wanting to send information by email should certainly try to limit that information and consider what constraints are applicable and act accordingly.
Let's move on to myth number two, which is related to myth number one. I guess one way one could avoid all of the issues relevant to transmission of PHI by email or any electronic mode of communication is to simply issue the edict or create the policy in an institution that states, thou shalt not send PHI by email. Is this a reasonable policy to adopt?
Well, it sure does seem that the middle ground gets lost a lot when it comes to emailing PHI. We just discussed the idea that not all PHI should be sent via email. It's also arguable that some PHI should be sent by email. But of course, the devil is in the details. HIPAA doesn't ban all email communication. Rather, it requires that a reasonable and appropriate safeguard be put in place to protect any PHI that is sent. Just to kind of back up and keep in mind what the risks are that we're talking about, email poses several risks related to confidentiality of patient information. For example, some risks include that the email can be misdirected by putting the wrong email address into the email before sending it. We've all had this happen at our institutions where these drop-down lists come into our email and auto-populate the to field. And if you have similar names, then it's not uncommon for the email to be directed to the wrong individual. So you really need to be careful and check that you're sending the email to the right person. Emails can also be at risk when they're sent from a device that is infected with some sort of malware that has made all the information on that device accessible to hackers or other malicious individuals. So that's a risk to sending information electronically. Emails also can be sent through commercial email providers such as Gmail and Hotmail. And those providers keep copies very often of emails on their own servers where they're beyond the control of the sender or the recipient of the email, and that poses a risk. But probably the biggest risk that we hear about with sending information by email is when that email is stored on an unsecured or easily lost device and that device is lost or stolen. So when you think about smartphones and laptops, these are commonly subject to theft or can be small and can be lost. And if the device is not encrypted and it's stolen, all those emails that are sitting on that device are accessible to the thief, which could lead to a breach of confidentiality, which may itself be a HIPAA violation subject to the civil and monetary penalties of HIPAA. So these risks are really the driving force for institutions to put in place edicts such as you may not send any PHI by email. And that's one way to protect it. On the other hand, email is a means to rapidly communicate information that in some cases is going to be very useful for treatment purposes. And the regulators who drafted HIPAA were clear that HIPAA should not be interfering with quality patient care. In fact, one of the anticipated benefits of HIPAA was to facilitate patient care by reassuring patients that the privacy of any information that they provide to their clinician will not be shared inappropriately and will be protected, thus allowing the patient to feel confident that they can share all their health information with their clinician. So I would argue that the real answer here is to create a balance between the idea that you can send everything and that you can send nothing. You need to balance the need to protect the privacy of patient information with the need to optimize patient care by allowing for rapid communication of relevant treatment information when it's needed. Of course, not all information needs to go out by email, but that information that is needed urgently to treat a patient and which, when done with measures incorporated to minimize the likelihood of any risks, such as we described above, coming to fruition. So, for example, to make sure that the recipient's address is correct and using devices with encryption and not forwarding emails to commercial email addresses and things like that, you would be able to safely or with a reasonable level of safety send information by email. My general rule of thumb would be to use email for what in instances when doing so will facilitate patient care, and not just because it's convenient for you as a clinician, but use it and maximize its ability to further improve patient care.
Thank you, Dr. Borgi. You know, with regard to the issue of encryption to protect protected health information, it's interesting to note here that as of 1 January 2013, there were 525 postings of breaches of unsecured PHI affecting 500 or more individuals that were reported to HHS. And the first monetary penalty in 2013 amounted to $50,000. And what's interesting about that particular case is it was based on the theft of a laptop computer containing unencrypted data on 441 patients, despite the fact that there was no indication that any PHI was improperly viewed or accessed. So simply having a breach that created the possibility of PHI being improperly viewed or accessed was sufficient to warrant a penalty, and the largest civil monetary penalty to date, just to give the audience some idea of sort of the lower and upper limit, at least of penalties to date in terms of monetary amounts, The largest has been $4.3 million for a violation of the privacy rule that occurred in 2011. So certainly maintaining the privacy, security, and confidentiality of protected health information is important from a variety of perspectives, not the least of which is the monetary penalties that can be rather significant for failure to provide those safeguards. So, Dr. Borgi, let's move on to myth number three. If PHI is sent by email, patient identifiers must be excluded. And I think this myth gets to the point that, believe it or not, some individuals would send emails containing protected health information, but without any kind of patient identifier, how can the intended recipient of that email know to whom the protected PHI in that email pertains if there isn't some way of providing a patient identifier? What's the reality?
Well, you know, that's correct. HIPAA's list of identifiers are quite broad, making it really difficult to de-identify information and yet still have that information still be useful for treatment purposes. Obviously, if the information is de-identified, you seriously reduce your risk of a breach of PHI. But again, it becomes, as you described, unusable for treatment purposes. So, for example, if you send an email referring to, for example, the patient we discussed who was admitted today, and sending that by an email where you've got it date stamped, that would be considered identifiable by virtue of their date of admission being included through the date stamp on the email. Further, in order for the information to be useful in treating a patient, one needs to know which patient the information refers to. So the identifiers are going to be needed if we're really going to utilize email. But one can be thoughtful about what identifiers can be used to minimize the identifiability of the information to those who actually aren't involved in the patient care. So, for example, the use of a medical record number would have limited utility in identifying a patient to those without access to the medical record system, but it would allow a treating clinician to know to whom the email is referring. And of course, as the sensitivity of the PHI increases, so should the caution on what identifiers would be included when sending a relatively benign information that is urgently needed, it might be reasonable to refer to the patient by name. But as the sensitivity of the information increases, such as mental health information, you'd want to use a less direct identifier.
Thank you. Well, let's move on to myth number four. Dr. Borgi, this myth relates to laboratory test results, and the myth is that laboratory test results must not be included in an email containing PHI. Again, what is the reality?
Well, laboratory test results are not any different than any other PHI, so the rules and precautions we just described would apply. Obviously, there's a big difference between an HIV test result and cholesterol levels, and so one needs to consider the sensitivity of the information and whether email is really the appropriate mode of communication. If the information isn't needed quickly, then it's not unreasonable to send the information by fax or mail, as it may better protect the information and the delay would not impact patient care. However, if the delay is going to be detrimental to patient care, it's certainly reasonable to send the information by email, including some limited patient identifiers.
Very good. Well, we're moving on to our last myth, which is one of my favorites. When discussing discordant or questionable laboratory test results by email, the principal concern should be to avoid any legal risk associated with the information provided by using generic phrases or disclaimers, such as, "We are investigating your concern, including review of QC processes and procedures, and repeat testing." Should that be the principal concern when responding to a clinician's query regarding discordant or questionable laboratory test results?
Of course, everyone is always concerned about legal risk, and as you just discussed, HIPAA alone can lead to very significant fines, and it can also lead to jail time for individuals who violate HIPAA. But fear of legal risk shouldn't outweigh the need to provide the best possible patient care and to provide treatment-related information in a timely manner. In cases where providing information via email is in the patient's best interests and precautions are taken to minimize the email ending up in accessible to unauthorized individuals, the email might actually be appropriate, including some treatment-related information in that email. So I think this issue is one that will continue to be debated, and as the technologies continue to change, both in terms as medicine evolves and technology evolves, we're going to need to embrace these newer and faster modes of communicating PHI. And improving patient care will require the incorporation of the benefits of these new modes of communication while remaining mindful of the importance of protecting the confidentiality and privacy of PHI transmitted by electronic modes, especially by email. By incorporating a mix of technical, things like encryption, and behavioral, things like minimizing the inclusion of information with superfluous direct identifiers, the advantages of email can be used to successfully optimize patient care. To assist individuals with ensuring that their email communication of PHI meets these standards optimally for ensuring the security and privacy of these communications, we've developed an Excel template containing the key elements of HIPAA and the privacy and security rules that better enables users to meet the requirements of HIPAA and these rules. And the template is available upon request by email to Dr. Wiens at fwiensjr@yahoo.com. So I want to thank again the ASEP for allowing us to present this podcast, and to my co-presenter, Dr. Wiens, and the podcast organizer, Kelly Swales, and I hope that we've enlightened some people on this issue.
Excellent. Thank you guys so much, Dr. Wiens and Dr. Borgi. I know our listeners will have gotten a lot of great information from you guys, and I thank you guys for joining us today.
Thank you, Kelly. We enjoyed it.